Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
From the Society for Nautical Research, in partnership with Lloyd's Register Foundation, I'm Sam Willis, and this is the Mariner's Mirror podcast, the world's number one podcast dedicated to all of maritime history. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Mariner's Mirror podcast, and to this, the second of several episodes dedicated to maritime Australia. I have begun my odyssey in Fremantle, in Western Australia, the location of the truly fabulous Western Australian Shipwrecks Museum and the Western Australian Maritime Museum. In episode one, I spoke with Ellie Spillecombe about the Dutch in Western Australia, a fascinating story of discovery, mistakes, perseverance, and courage. Today, we're following up on that theme, looking in particular at the Duyfkin, the small Dutch ship which, in 1606, is credited as being the first vessel on board of which a European crew first sighted the Australian mainland. Now, to tell me more about this ship and this amazing moment in time, and also the replica of the Duyfkin that was built and then launched in Fremantle in 1999, I spoke with Graham Cox. Graham was a founding member of the Duyfkin 1606 Replica Foundation, and later he became project director. He was responsible for the launch and the final fit-out of the replica, and then he was responsible for the history-making Chevron 2000 Duyfkin expedition to Indonesia, Papua New Guinea and Queensland, and the VOC 2002 Duyfkin voyage from Sydney to Indonesia and the Netherlands. This was the longest Age of Discovery replica ship voyage ever completed. Graham is the author of a book to be released later this year titled Through Darkest Seas, which documents the building of the Duyfkin replica and tells the story of the ship's voyages through Indonesia and around the world. Here is a man with a wry smile, a twinkle in his eye, and the occasional faraway look as the phenomenal logistical difficulties of a maritime challenge like no other come back to haunt him. As ever, I hope that you enjoy listening to him as much as I enjoyed talking with him. Here is the charming Graham. I'm sitting outside the Shipwrecks Museum in Fremantle with Graham, who's come to tell me all about building the Duyfkin and the history of the Duyfkin. But you just let it slip that you're a Fremantle boy. So can you tell me a little bit about this place? Tell me about the history of Fremantle.
Oh, the history of Fremantle. Well, Fremantle begins in 1829, but a long time before that. Where we're sitting here, there was an Aboriginal community living, and they used to go and feast on the whales, which used to be washed ashore just near here.
Right.
And you'll know that the roundhouse is just down the road here, which was when the Europeans came here and started exploiting the whales underneath, and then they built a jail up on top. So we're right in the spot where Aborigines used to gather, and then they would cross the sandbar at the entrance to the Swan River. Yeah. Of course, in 1829, the first European colony began here with Governor Stirling.
And this big building behind us, which houses the museum, that was a warehouse and built by convicts, I presume?
Yes, it's a customs house. You see, all of the buildings here are built in limestone because there's limestone everywhere.
Yeah.
It's an old reef, and Fremantle's built on an old coral reef, really, limestone reef. And so this area is incredibly interesting.
Yeah.
This is really where the colony of Western Australia began, or as it was then, the Swan River Colony.
Yeah. And then they moved down to Perth a little later.
Fairly quickly they moved up to Perth, you know, east of here, up the Swan River, which had been known for by the Europeans for 150 years before the colonists arrived through the Dutch discoveries along this coast.
Yeah.
So Fremantle is sort of like, well, what would you say, the originating colony of Western Australia if you take Albany out on the south coast.
Yeah.
But incredibly historic place. Most of the buildings you'll see in Fremantle are from the 1890s, and that was when the gold rushes began here, which was the richest mile of gold-bearing earth in the world,
really,
which is 800 kilometres east of here at Kalgoorlie. So this became a boom town during the gold rush years. Yeah.
So much history. But we're here to talk about the Dutch, so yes. I'm going to make you stop talking about Fremantle, even though I'd like to listen to you all day talking about the wonders of Fremantle. The Duyfken.
Yes.
So that's what we're going to be talking about today. Let's sort of go back to the beginning. Why was the ship a significant vessel?
Well, the Dutch went to Indonesia in around 1598 to try to exploit the spice trade, which had been dominated by the Portuguese up to that time. And they had fast, incredibly strong and manoeuvrable vessels, the Dutch East Indiamen, as they became known. And they were superior to the Portuguese ships. The first Dutch fleet went to the Indies in 1598. In 1606, there was another fleet to the Indies, and a small ship, a yacht, it was called. I have to do that with the guttural, yacht. It's better. Not enough saliva. There was a yacht, which was the scout ships of the fleet, and there were usually a couple of them, and then there were the big East Indiamen. So the East Indian might be 6,000-7,000 tons. The yachts were, or yachts, were 110, 120, 130 tons, and this was one of those ships. The captain of the ship, William Jansz, was ordered by Coon, the governor of the Indies at that time, to go off in search of a land of gold called Nova Guinea. And it was, I've heard on one of your previous podcasts about Magellan and his search for gold.
Yeah.
And this was the same thing, but another 80 years later. And so they'd heard about this mythical land of gold called Nova Guinea, not to be confused with present-day New Guinea. And so the seasons were right, and they sent this small ship off southeast to find this land of gold. And instead, they went on the monsoon, which blows down. The monsoon's blowing now, and
yeah,
you
is,
know
yeah.
about all of the floods in the north of Western Australia at the moment. The monsoon is blowing, was blowing, and it blew them to Cape York in Queensland, Cape York Peninsula, the Gulf of Carpentaria, which wasn't named that at the time, of course. And they sailed 250 miles down the coast, mapped it, landed, although that's always up for debate about how many times they landed, where they landed. And then they sailed back, got into a lot of trouble on the way back, ended up back at Banda, the spice island for nutmeg and mace.
Yeah.
And was reported, their arrival was reported by John Sarris, an English merchant. So we know about that. And that voyage to Australia in 1606 was the first time recorded in history that Aboriginal people met people from the outside world. First time recorded in history that Australia appeared on a map. And the first time that Europeans recorded in history, because it always has to be recorded in history, first time Europeans set foot on Australian soil. Now, that began 164 years of Dutch exploration and visiting the Australian coastline.
They liked what they found.
They didn't like it. They didn't see anything they wanted to stay for. As the Dutch East India Company said, God is good, but trade is better.
Yep.
And so they didn't find anything which they could see of value that they could trade for.
Yeah.
The Aboriginal people weren't particularly friendly to them,
no.
Although that's up for discussion as well. But in the next 164 years, there was something like 42 voyages by the Dutch to Australia. They mapped three quarters of the Australian coastline, and then an English gentleman, Lieutenant James Cook, sailed up the eastern coast of Australia, mapped the last quarter of the continent, and that led to the European colonisation.
Yes. So there was no settlement from the Dutch.
The Dutch never settled here. A lot of their ships were wrecked along this coast,
yep.
And you talked about the shipwrecks that, yeah. Galleries. And some of them survived, and they became the first European residents of Australia, I guess, by misfortune,
yeah.
Rather than anything else. But it was...
A couple of unlucky ones were marooned as well. Was that off the Batavia?
Yes, they were marooned. Didn't have any choice in that matter.
No.
But there's a lot of work being done here by a fellow, Rupert Gerritsen, about the Dutch bloodlines in the Aboriginal communities around Geraldton, which is... 500 kilometres north of here. So there's that, their legacy, I guess, in Western Australia.
The Aboriginal rock art of ships, I thought, was extraordinary. Do you know much about that?
It is, yeah. There's rock art, there's also the ochre paintings in caves.
Mm.
There's one in Queensland which looks like a dead ringer for the Dyfken.
Yeah. So these, I should have said, these specifically it's art of vessels, of the maritime world.
Yeah, so they're there. The other thing is Bruce Chatwin wrote about it in the Songlines book many years ago, about how stories were transferred over hundreds of years. And if you go to the Cape York Peninsula in Queensland, the stories of the Dyfken are still in the stories of the area, and there's some discussion about how missionaries have reinforced or changed those stories through teaching. But basically, if you go to around the Pennefather River, where William Yance first set foot on Australian soil, they tell the story of the ghosts arriving and the sails. It's a staggering story.
Yeah. So let's talk about the making of the replica. Whose idea was that?
Well, a guy called Michael Young, who's a Fremantle boy as well. Michael was a Dutch migrant to Australia. His family settled in Sydney. He was staying on a farm and would sneak into the library on the farm and read books about exploration, and was outraged that they always talked about Captain Cook. Of course, he was Lieutenant Cook when he sailed along Australia. But I always talk about Captain Cook.
Yeah.
And he was just a teenager. And then in his 50s, by then he was living in Fremantle. The Endeavour replica had been built here,
yep.
For the Australian Bicentenary. And that ship was hugely popular in Fremantle. It was regarded, we regarded it as our ship, something...
Is it in Sydney?
We've done it. She's in Sydney now, yeah. And right, more next to Dyfken, actually, at the National Maritime Museum. So Endeavour was built. He wrote a letter to the Fremantle Herald, and the Fremantle Herald's office is about 50 metres from
Wonderful.
Us, just in the next building. And he said, look, the Endeavour's leaving Fremantle, because it was always going to leave Fremantle. Ships that are built in a place for who really spend their whole
lives—they're supposed to leave, aren't they? That's the whole point of them.
The whole point of it. So he said, "Why don't we build the Dyfken? That's the first ship in Australia's history. It's a small ship. It'll only cost $3 or $4 million to build. Endeavour cost $16 million dollars to build, so it was a big project. This will only cost $3 or $4 million to build. That's not much if you say it quickly." The little local newspaper was flooded with letters. And then the state newspaper, the West Australian newspaper, republished the letter. And that created a huge flood of interest. And I was involved with Endeavour in those days, and John Longley ran in the Endeavour project, and I had a chat with him. And he said, I don't want to be involved in it, but there's these people, there's a whole group of them forming to do this. And he said, they know nothing about marketing and business. You should give them a ring and see if you can help them out. And that's how I got involved, which is like how a lot of other people got involved.
Yeah.
And then the breakthrough, really, in the whole process was Michael George Kalis, M.G. Kalis, whose ships you can still see in the harbour here, yeah. all the blue and white ones, because yeah. he's of Greek descent. No longer owned by Michael. Michael passed away in 2000, but he agreed to join the foundation because he was interested in the maritime history of Australia. And that was the breakthrough. And then for years we fundraised, and then we built the ship with ambition to build the most authentic Age of Discovery replica ship ever built.
Okay. How did you go about doing that? I mean, where did you get the lines for the vessel from?
The lines for the vessel were interesting. A wreck called SO1 in the Netherlands, in the mud in a field, where, as you know, the old Zuider Zee, the IJsselmeer today, has hundreds and hundreds of shipwrecks under the mud on fields on the land. And this one called SO1 was a yacht, and the lines for the ship were unusual. Dutch maritime art usually shows very bulbous hulled ships, mm-hmm. you know, high stern and bow, and they always look a bit of, how on earth could that sail? Well, this wreck was found and measured, and it showed incredibly sleek lines.
Right,
and that confirmed a lot of what our archaeologist Nick Birmingham, who designed the ship along with Adrian Dion, Nick looked at the records of these voyages and thought, these ships are fast, these yachts, they're fast little ships, they're not big hulking East no. Indian, and these are really smart little ships, and this confirmed that. So we computer modelled the hull, tested it in the computer modelling through a local company here called Max Surf, which designed this ship design program, a very popular one, and found that we had the hull. This was the hull. This hull shape must produce a yacht of the speed that the original ship accomplished.
Right.
And so then we said...
And you worked out the speed the original ship accomplished through the logs of its records.
Yes, yeah. yes. All of the.
Where are those kept?
Those are in the Netherlands at the Rijksmuseum.
Yeah.
And very rarely had anybody looked at those records for that sort of information. And fortunately, we had a historian who worked here, Marit van Hauste, who was living in Perth and finishing her doctorate, and she. She studied the records in Dutch, in the original Dutch. It's very little of the 20 years ago of the Dutch records had been translated into English. And I think most of them had been done here,
yeah.
really, in this museum. So she worked out that there were three Dyfkins, and ours was the second one, not the first one, from 1598, and not the third one. So we had the right ship, we had the design, the hull design, and then we just had to get it right. And the Endeavour, which had been put together here, was built with Australian hardwoods, which are very durable for building ships. But we decided, and because we were working with the museum here, that we would have this ambition of building the most exacting
yeah.
replica. So we bought European oak from Latvia.
Okay.
The floors, the futtocks, the knees, the planks, and everything, shipped it out here, and built using fire. And this
built using fire. Let's explore that sentence.
Right. Okay. When wood has a lot of cellulose in it, when you heat cellulose up to the point that just before it starts burning, it becomes malleable and you can shape it, which is why people who make spears have straight spears, because they straighten them in the fire. They don't start out necessarily with straight wood. It's the same technology that's been used for tens of thousands of years. But the Dutch used fire to build the ships. So instead of putting up all of the ribs of the ship, if you like, the floors, the futtocks and the knees, the ribs of the ship, you would actually build the hull, put up the hull planks first, and then fill out the ship inside. Okay. So we had that challenge here. So we set up a hearth, and the hearth was only about 100 or 50 metres from here, just in the front of the Maritime Museum.
Yeah.
We set up a hearth, We had this raw timber from Latvia, still with chunks of shrapnel in it from World War II, lot of it, because there was a lot of battles in Latvia. And then we started to learn how to do it. Fortunately, Nick Birmingham had spent a lot of time in Indonesia studying Indonesian boat building techniques, because they still build using fire in Indonesia. So it was in our region, it's a known thing. But we had to learn it. Bill Leonard, the master shipwright, who is an absolute genius at building wooden ships, he was in charge of it, and he got his people working on it, and they worked it out. It took, I think, 6 weeks to put the first plank on.
Try and work out how to do it. So let's go back to the hearth. So it's a hearth that's burning with coke?
With the offcuts from the timber. These wooden ships are built on a 3-2-1 principle. So you have if you have 3 tons of timber that you pull out of the forest, you have 2 tons of timber once you've sliced it, and then you have 1 ton of timber that actually goes on the ship as a component.
And 321 problems to deal with.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
The first one, which is the stuff you've put out of the forest, that's all cut up to make the planks. That timber is then used to fire the hearth to bend the planks. So you set up a fire underneath. You have a structure with big pegs on it, and you put the plank in at the height where you get the temperature right according to the amount of timber you've got. And then they use these massive pegs, like clothes pegs, to pull the enormous plank into shape.
Yeah.
So we figured when the boys first started doing it that if it takes 6 weeks to do one multiplied by 250 planks, we're going to be here a long time. But they soon sorted it out, and they could bend a plank in a day or two,
right,
and get it to the right shape. So every single plank on the ship was bent using fire.
Amazing, amazing.
And then,
how are the planks attached to each other?
The planks aren't attached to each other. They're attached to the knees of the ship, the floors and the futtocks, the inside shapes. And trunnels are used for those.
Okay.
And this was people listening may know about the Matthew replica in Bristol.
Yeah.
And that was originally built with trunnels, tree nails, which are effectively big pegs that you bang into the ship. But the replica was made using bolts, and we had heard that they'd had problems with their bolts. They had to keep tightening them as the timber shrank and as the ship moved. So we thought we'd go back again. Authenticity. We're sitting right next to the Batavia hull, which is all put together with trunnels, just on the other side of this wall. And so we used trunnels, 3,000 of them, I think. Every trunnel had
from the same type of timber, or did you use particular?
Yeah, same sort of timber, still from the oak. School children would write their names on the trundles when they came to visit.
Yeah.
So it's got thousands of names of school children on it.
That's brilliant.
With this ship all hidden. And they are nailed in. The bitter end is cut off, as they call it, and then a wedge is put in. And the ship is now, well, she's now 22 years old. Those planks were put in 23 years ago. They're still as tight on the ship as the day they were put in, and it's because of the shearing strength of a trunnel compared with the strength of a coach bolt, which pulls in to the ship. A trunnel expands in the hole and creates this incredible shear strength. So the ship was absolutely beautiful when it was completed with all of this timber work.
How long did it take for it to be finished?
3 or 4 years. I'm trying to think of the exact time, but it was over the years. And then we launched her in about this time of the year in 1999.
Let's talk about the rigging for a bit.
Yeah.
Let's talk about, we talked about the hull. How did you get a plan for what the masts and the rigging, the sails?
Well, the ship's very simply rigged. It's rigged. It's a square sail ship with a lateen and a bowsprit. We were lucky here that just after World War II in WA, the government here started collecting seeds from trees to grow pine as a local timber industry here, and they went to Portugal and got Pinus panaster, maritime pine, and planted it here.
There are a phenomenal amount of pines here. I was amazed.
Well, we're here with all the Norfolk Island pines, but they're useless for
shipbuilding. They look great, though.
They look great. But so panaster pine trees were here, and we were given as many as we wanted because there's a lot of iron in the soil here, and it's very discoloured white timber. So nobody really uses it here, but they've got the plantations are all over the place. So we were given those. So the ship has solid trunk masts, pretty much built from the same timber that the original ship would have been built from, because in 1600, lowland Europe had run out of forests, and so they were getting the timber from the Baltic, from places like Latvia, and the timber for masts from places like Portugal and Spain in that incredible... era when Europe was decimated of its forests, and so it has that. We also decided that the ship should have authentic sails. So the sails were actually milled in the UK by a British Millerane company, and the sails were made from flax and woven to the width of the original weave. And they were woven on machines. Because if we'd woven them by hand, we'd still be talking about it. And then the ropes were made from hemp and hemp fibre, and on 150-year-old rope walks in the Netherlands, actually. And every single rope was hemp. That created a beautiful ship to sail, because hemp is really nice on the hands, especially once it's been oiled. So compared with more modern manila fibre, or even, heaven forbid, modern plastic rope, hemp rope is beautiful, you know, to pull on if you're a sailor. So the ship had completely original rigging, which has proven to be a curse in a way. It was great at the time, but of course the sailors on these ships were constantly repairing the rig. It was constantly rotting and falling apart. And as one of the captains, Peter Manthorpe, said to me, one of the ship's masters, when I was complaining about the huge costs we had of maintenance, because the maintenance costs are extraordinary, he said, you've got to understand, these ships are constantly oxidising lumps of organic matter. And so the crew is constantly repairing them.
Yeah,
and we discovered that on our voyages, that there wasn't a day where you just sat and looked at the sails and congratulated yourself.
I've not done well. Let's talk about those voyages, because you managed to sail the ship quite remarkable distances.
Yes, well, the second voyage was the equivalent of sailing around the world at the equator. That was a big voyage. The first one left here in 2000, from near here as well, just over the road from here at Fremantle Fishing Boat Harbour, and we sailed to Indonesia. to reenact the original voyage of discovery from Banda to Cape York. So yep. First we had to sail to Indonesia, which is 4,000 kilometres, no, more than that, north of here. And so we sailed up the West Australian coast the correct way, which is always sail north up the West Australian coast, because the winds are from the southwest. So we sailed.
They're pretty regular. They're like clockwork here. Yeah, winds blow every afternoon. Every, you know, they come in pretty reliably. Does that happen all year?
No, in winter the patterns change a bit because you get the winter storms here. But in summer, you're pretty right. Yeah. We left from about this time, a little bit later than this, April, from here.
Yeah.
And had a blistering sail up the coast. We didn't crash into anything except one small object on the way. It was a fine voyage north, and going to places like where the Batavia shipwreck is. We visited there, with the Zuiddorp cliffs, where which are famous cliffs to Cape Inscription, where the first piece of European memorabilia was
The plate. We've heard about that. Plates. It's called Cape Inscription, is
Cape
it?
Inscription.
I think that's fantastic.
Yes. and we left our own, actually. We made an aluminium plate, and the ship's carpenter etched everybody's name on
very
it,
nice.
And we popped it there. So I think that's in the Shark Bay Council. We did that just as a bit of fun.
Yeah.
But Indonesia at the time was in a terrible state. It had just got independence. The various political groups and ethnic groups were all fighting for control, testing the democratic government. We were due to go to Ternate and Makian and Ambon in the Spice Islands. There's a civil war basically going on there. So we didn't make it to there, but we got to Banda, which is the Nutmeg Island, which is where the ship originally left from.
Yeah.
We couldn't get insurance to sail in summer, because of the cyclone risk. No insurance company in the world, those gentlemen at Lloyd's,
having none of
talk
it.
About, would have none of that. Yeah. You cannot sail a sailing ship like ours above the Tropic of Capricorn in summer. Forget it. So we couldn't get the ship insured, so we sailed in winter. This was a curse. We got to Banda, and the southeast trade winds were blowing.
Mm.
And we had to sail between Papua New Guinea and Australia. There's a corridor that we had to sail down, and it was a nightmare.
In a southeasterly direction.
Southeasterly the wind direction, straight in the face. A ship that's designed to sail on the trade winds with the wind behind you.
Yeah.
So we sailed. I wasn't on board. I was organising the arrival. But we sailed in the most terrible voyage, running out of food. We weren't allowed to visit Irian Jaya because of the problems at the Freeport gold mine at the time. It's a very controversial mine. But the crew, to their credit, ate dal for 4 weeks because they ran out of food. And some of them still say that they will never eat dal again in their lives. And we made it to the Pennefather River on the Gulf of Carpentaria. We did something which I think has never been done before in Australia by Europeans. We asked for permission to land.
Very good.
and the Aboriginal people, the custodians of the Pennefather River, gave us permission to land, so we did. If they didn't, we would have sailed away. And that was the end of the first voyage, apart from a very big exhibition tour, which got us down to Sydney.
Mm.
We arrived in Sydney completely broke. We were only a charitable foundation, just a bunch of people wanting to do something. And the Dutch government was wanting to celebrate the 400th anniversary of the Dutch East India Company. And the word celebration is a mixed one these days.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very troubled history there, isn't it?
Very troubled history. I was approached in Jakarta, when we were in Jakarta, whether the ship would be interested in going to the Netherlands. And the Dutch said, oh, this is fine. We've got lots of ships. We can put your ship on and take it to the Netherlands. And we said, no, we don't do that.
I was missing the point.
We don't ship our ship. We sail our ship. They said, it'll never work. Nobody's done it. Nobody's ever sailed a ship like this around the world. it's a dumb idea. And the Dutch government doesn't want to support it because what if you all die and it'll all come back on us? And so I said, no, we're not going unless we sail the ship. And discussions ensued. We came up with a budget which included all sorts of safety equipment. I think for the first time ever, this was 22 years ago, every crew member had an EPIRB. The ship had its own EPIRB. There was the
Can
other...
Can you explain what the EPIRB is for our listeners?
A personal location beacon for each person, a satellite beacon. So every single crew member had to have a satellite beacon. We had survival suits, which are usually only used in the Arctic or the Antarctic, but we had survival suits for everybody, the whole box and dice. And we convinced them that we should sail the ship and that it would be fantastic for the ship to sail on the Brouwer route back to the Netherlands. The Brouwer route, of course, across the Indian Ocean, the famous trading route to the east. So we left Sydney, and it was a voyage that had all sorts of challenges. The longest leg was 55 days through the Atlantic. We sailed up to Jakarta. We hadn't been allowed into Jakarta the year before because of the colonial overtones of the ship. But we were allowed back into Jakarta. So we left from Sunda Kelapa, the old port of Jakarta, sailed to Galle, Sri Lanka, the biggest VOC port in the Indian Ocean, down to Mauritius, to Rodrigues Island, which Dyfken was the first ship recorded in history to visit Rodrigues Island, which was like an amazing place. Then down to Cape Town, where we refitted the ship, cleaned out the dirty fuel in the tanks, because she has diesel engines to get into and out of port, and then sailed up through the Atlantic to the island of Texel in the Netherlands. And that was the longest voyage of a ship of this kind in modern times. And the crew, pretty much...
How many?
The crew of the ship is 18. On that voyage, we had about 16. It floated a little bit. But most of the people that left Sydney arrived in Texel in the Netherlands, and then we scooted up to Amsterdam for the other grand arrival. Crown Prince Willem Alexander welcomed the ship to arrive. It was a big deal. 20,000 people were there to see us. Millions of people came to see the ship during the summer exhibition tour in the Netherlands. And that's all the good news. A lot of the crew members, I think, are still wondering why they did it. The severe lack of foresight was one crew member, and I asked him why he did it. But it was an amazing accomplishment for the crew to sail this ship, which has, just to give you an idea, it has, there's only one cabin, that's the captain's cabin. It only has two bunks and the chart table. So 24 hours a day, that room's got people going in and out, making annotations on the charts. The crew sleep down below or when it's hot on deck. So basically you've got 14 people camping in an area the size of a double car garage for a year.
Wow.
And there were only 7 stops in the year. So it took a year to get there. I still look back on that with some pride that I put that voyage together. Yeah. And we accomplished it without the loss of any crew members, without any major illnesses, which of course is the great fear from these ships. The ship survived the Agulhas Current east of South Africa. It's a horrendous part of the world. The crew were magnificent there, sailing the skirting the Agulhas Bank. Yes, that's the story of Dyfken.
Wonderful, wonderful story it is. Thank you very much indeed for sharing it with me.
Pleasure.
That
Thank you all so much for listening. Now, please don't let this be the last thing that you do to interact with our fabulous podcast. Firstly, go to YouTube, find the Mariner's Mirror podcast's YouTube page and watch some videos. It's phenomenal. An ever-growing library of some of the most extraordinary and innovative videos showcasing our maritime past in new ways. My current favourite is the 3D animation showing how a 250-ton, 21-metre and 3,500-year-old granite obelisk was shipped from Alexandria to London in 1878. And if you're interested in maritime technologies, I know that many of you are, please look at the animation explaining how a curious 19th century propeller worked. This one had blades that moved in opposite directions. It's gone viral online. The clip has been seen nearly 4.5 million times. As always, please remember that the podcast comes from both the Society for Nautical Research and the Lloyd's Register Foundation. You can find them both online, the Society for Nautical Research at snr.org.uk, where I would encourage you to visit and to join. It's a great way to meet people with similar interests and a fantastic place to learn all about the maritime past from the world's best maritime historians. The History and Education Centre of the Lloyd's Register Foundation, which has been certifying the safety of ships since 1760, you can find at hec.lrfoundation.org.uk. And if you're interested in maritime technology, do please check out Maritime Innovation in Miniature. Just Google it and you will see the world's greatest ship models filmed with the latest camera equipment. You will not believe your eyes.
flowers.com is more than your birthday, anniversary, or just because gift-giving destination. We put our hearts into everything we do to help you celebrate all life's special occasions with friends and family. From our farmers and bakers, florists and makers, everything from 1-800-Flowers is made with love every step of the way, because we know that nothing is more important than delivering a smile. To learn more, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.